Buenas noches. This is Ottavio Canzone welcoming you to Blood of Kings on the Fandom Podcast Network.
Welcome, Highlander fans, to episode 114 of Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we cover all things Highlander, including the movies, the TV series, guest interviews, novels, audiobooks, comics, special events, and interviews and reports from the Seacouver 2019 tour, part 4, and more. I'm Kevin, your Blood of Kings Highlander podcast host. In April of 2019, this last year, yours truly, Kevin Reitzel, joined location master Andy Sloan for his Seacouver 2019 tour in the beautiful city of Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Vancouver, Canada provided the filming locations for the fictitious city of Seacouver for the 1990s Highlander TV show. The first half of each season was filmed in Vancouver, then the second half of the season moved production and location to Paris, France. Andy Sloan has been running these tours of Seacouver and Vancouver for several years. His knowledge of the Highlander filming locations is extensive and very well organized and researched. I spent a week in Vancouver with Andy touring many locations from most of the Highlander filming locations in the Vancouver area, which included many fan favorite episodes and iconic Highlander scenes and locations. I'm really excited to share my adventures and interviews from Andy Sloan's Seacouver 2019 tour. Recently, I've been posting many of the videos that I took on the tour of the filming location to the Blood of Kings Highlander Fandom Facebook group. If you look under photos section of the page, you will find them there. I recorded over 50 videos, and I tell you, Andy and I had a lot of fun with these videos, and it gives you kind of firsthand experience of like being there. But of course, it's a lot more fun being there in person with Andy touring this beautiful city and checking out, of course, all of our favorite Highlander locations. This is Blood of Kings episode 14, Seacouver Tour Chronicles part 4, our interview with Highlander alumni Efron McAsh and Gillian Horvath. Before we move on, though, I want to let you guys know what's been happening recently on Blood of Kings. As I mentioned, this is part 4 of the Seacouver Tour Chronicles. In the recent episodes, we had part 3 where we had an interview with Highlander production designer Stephen Gagan and sculptor and art director Susan Suki Parker. In part 2, we had an interview with Highlander television director Richard Martin. And in part 1, we started all off with our interview, of course, with location master Andy Sloan talking about this tour and everything that he put into it. And went down memory lane about the previous week, and we had a fun time doing that interview. And then also on that episode, we had an interview with Highlander actor Kim Condershaft. Previously, we did some great character profiles. We did Charlie DeSalvo with special guest David Walsh. We did Darius with special guest Sean Dempsey. We also did a beginner's perspective, part 2 with my friend Robert Baps, who is new to Highlander. And of course, we did Highlander season 4, See It or Skip It, part 1 and 2, the Seacouver in Paris episodes with special guest John Mosby. Now, before we go on, we want to mention how you can contact us here. First of all, I want to thank all of you fans for supporting the show. And if you'd like to get in touch with us online and through social media, here is how you can do so. You can find Blood of Kings on the Fandom Podcast Network master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The FPNet is also on the Podbean app. Fandom Podcast Network is now on Apple Podcast, formerly iTunes. We're on Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Blood of Kings Pod. You can also, as I mentioned before, we're also on Facebook, the Blood of Kings, a Highlander fandom group. We've got a lot of great fans there talking about Highlander and sharing stories and pictures. And we also got a lot of people that are part of Highlander that were both behind and in front of the camera that are part of that group. We also have the sister group, the Facebook page, Bloody Kings, a Highlander CCG collectible card game and gaming discussion group page. If you'd like to contact us directly, you can email us at bloodykingspodcast@gmail.com. I'm Kevin. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix. You can find Kyle, who is also my fellow co-founder of the Fandom Podcast Network, is at AKyleW on Twitter and on Instagram at AKyleFandom. Now, if you guys want to go on the Seacouver tour, contact Andy Sloan. This guy's awesome. He's put so much love and work into this. So if you want to know more information about Seacouver Vancouver tour, if you got some inquiries, please contact Andy Sloan directly. You can email him at andysloan@hotmail.com. He's also on Twitter at locationsmaster. And you can also find Andy Sloan on Facebook. Sloan is spelled S-L-O-A-N-E. So make sure you check that out. There's two ways that you can support us here at the Fandom Podcast Network and Bloody Kings. Head on over to Apple Podcasts, of course, formerly iTunes, and please search Fandom Podcast Network and leave us a 5-star review. But we love feedback in general. You can also visit our Tee Public store. You can search Fandom Podcast Network and Bloody Kings, and you can get your own Bloody Kings t-shirts and other apparel. Like I said, just search Fandom Podcast Network and or Bloody Kings at the Tee Public website. All right. Now, what we also like to do here on Bloody Kings is we like to remind you about the upcoming Adrian Paul Sword Experiences. We love the Sword Experiences, and we always like to promote it here. So make sure you check out the website at swordxp.com. Coming soon, there are events in France, Panama, Boston, Seattle, and many more. I've done a couple myself. They are a lot of fun and a wonderful experience. We've got two Facebook groups for fans that want to share their experiences or find out more about the Sword Experience. You can visit Sword Experience Participants, experiences with an X. That's Priscilla Manriguez's Facebook page. We also got SXP, the Ultimate Sword Experience fan group that's run by Riley, Shan, Selena, Lonnie, and Gail. All right, coming up right now, Bloody Kings 114 Seacouver Tour Chronicles Part 4, our interview with Highlander alumni F. Bron McAsh and Gillian Horvath. As I mentioned earlier in the previous episodes for these Seacouver Tour Chronicles, Andy and I met up with Gillian, and we had a wonderful night checking out Jim Burns, who played Joe Dawson, of course, the Watcher and star of Highlander, the TV series, and we saw him live in concert performing with his blues band. It was absolutely wonderful. We also met up again with Gillian, and this is where we joined up with F. Bron McAsh, and we did some fantastic tours around Vancouver area with both those guys, checking out some locations. If you've been listening to the previous episodes, we had interviews, of course, with Andy Sloan, Kim Kondrasoff, actor for the Highlander TV series, Steve Gagan, the Highlander production designer, and, of course, the sculptor and art director, Susan Suki Parker. And we also did an interview with Richard Martin, the Highlander TV series director. And we got a couple of more interviews in the next episode with Jay Brazzo, actor for the Highlander TV series, and of course, Paul Bartlett. You may not know who he is, but he was a wonderful guy. He was the Gateway Theater Building and Services Supervisor. He works at the famous theater that was a filming location for the episode Song of the Executioner, the fight scene between Duncan and Kalis, where Duncan, instead of getting beheaded, decides to fall to his death in front of Anne Lindsay. And Paul has been the supervisor for that place. You know, he's been working there since that theater was open back in the 80s, and he gave us a full tour of the entire theater, and it was wonderful. Wonderful experience, and he was a great guy. And he gives his experiences working on that episode. All right, here we are, the main interview segment here. We are interviewing F. Bron McAsh, the Swordmaster for the Highlander TV series and Highlander Endgame, and Gillian Horvath, the Associate Creative Consultant and Script Coordinator for Highlander. Now, we after Andy and I had a wonderful afternoon with these two, we sat down at a coffee shop and decided to interview them and kind of, you know, obviously talk about our experiences that day, but also get some background on them and, you know, talking about their experiences working on Highlander and what it was like. And it was really interesting talking to Gillian, because one of the subjects that came up was, how did Seacouver get its name? And was it ever mentioned or shown in the TV series? And it was, sort of. And we talk about that. And of course, their wonderful experiences working on the show. And this was a fun interview to do with them. And I want to, first of all, thank both Braun and Gillian for their time and for their interview. And here is their interview. Hello, Bloody Kings and Highlander fans. I got a special treat for you. Currently, I am on my Seacouver 2019 tour with guest and host and awesome location manager, Mr. Andy Sloan.
Hello.
Having a really good time. We got a couple of great guests here for you guys. First of all, we have the lovely Gillian Horvath. How are you, Gillian?
Hello.
If you guys don't know by now, Gillian, of course, is a creative consultant and a writer for Highlander. We also have sword extraordinaire, weapons master, sword master, Mr. Efron McDash. How are you, sir?
I am not unwell, thank you.
Now, I want to ask you guys, we've been having a little bit of fun today. You've joined us on today's leg of Andy's Seacouver tour here in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And we went up to, Andy, why don't you tell us where we went to?
This morning or just now?
Just now.
Now we came from Mount Seymour Provincial Park in North Vancouver.
And what episodes were filmed up there?
Many episodes, but the very first episode, The Gathering, had several scenes shot there. The Indian Village flashback, of course. And then another area was where Duncan was building his cabin on holy ground. And then, of course, the cabin that's completed that he went to at the end, Tessa joined him there. That was there.
They also served the fight with Michael served. Christian
yep, that's
and
right.
Duncan.
Band of Brothers had that cabin again in season one. Lots of different things. Some scenes from Mountain Men,
right,
where Duncan jumps off the cliff.
The Battle of Waterloo.
The Battle
as well.
Of Waterloo, yeah. That's right, in Band of Brothers. And of course, the Scottish village from Homeland was set up down there as well.
It was still, there was still snow on the ground. It's late April right now. Very beautiful up there. But, Gillian, I want to ask you, when you were working for Highlander, you spent, of course, a lot of the time back at the offices creating, writing, but you got a chance to see a lot of dailies of the video that was taken, but you never got a chance to actually visit the locations that much. So tell, what was it like actually going up there now?
That's right. The writer's offices were down in Los Angeles, and I only came up to Vancouver for a couple of visits. So at the time, the only places I'd been to were the standing set, the dojo and loft, and to Border Town, where the Comes a Horseman flashbacks were filmed. And I was up here when they were filming Timeless, and I remember being in editing when the dailies came in for the rain scene that you guys enjoyed recreating for us the other day. But I didn't live in Vancouver full time until years after Highlander had finished filming, and so I was not even really aware of the exact location of much of the filming. Andy knows more about these locations than I do because I was not part of the on-set crew. For myself, when I first started living in Vancouver, I went for dinner with friends down in Gastown and found myself unexpectedly standing outside the dojo. I didn't know where that building had been, but I recognized it right away, and that was very exciting. And it's the same kind of fun to go around with Andy now. Absolutely, that cabin, even though I didn't work on season one, we watched every episode over and over and, know those scenes from The Gathering very well, and immediately took me back through the decades to feel like I'm actually standing there. So I'm really enjoying this, even though you'd think I'd be more jaded.
Braun, I wanted to ask you, you've had, it's been wonderful having you today checking out these filming locations. Of course, we were talking about the fight with Duncan and Canwolf in Homeland and such. And I want to ask you, what was are these bringing back some wonderful memories for you?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, as the Swordmaster fight choreographer, I really would only be on the set when we were actually filming fight scenes, but I was also on an awful lot of sets when we weren't filming fight scenes because they were the only time that I would be able to get the guest star or certain actors to actually rehearse before because rehearsal time, especially on our shooting schedule, was really, really at a premium. And even if you could only grab 15 minutes out of a day, that was very important. So I would be cruising around to an awful lot of these locations just to get the actors, but I wouldn't really be involved in whatever was going in front of the camera, and as a consequence, half of the time I barely even knew where I was. I was there to work with this person and that person, and that was pretty much it. Whatever was happening in front of the camera was immaterial to me, so going around with somebody who knows the locations far, far better than I do is actually a bit of an eye-opener for me. Even after all of these years, I'm going, well, I wasn't there the day they filmed that. I haven't the slightest idea where this shot was done or anything like this. So it's really great after all of these years. Kind of silly, but really fantastic to actually see for the first time some of the places I wasn't while they were filming all this stuff.
Well, quick follow-up question to what you said. If you could request a certain amount of time for rehearsal, what would be a good amount of time for each episode if it was up to you?
Well, there really is no ideal amount of time. One of the things that I sort of finalized was that most of the fights on Highlander, the big final fights, were four phrases. A phrase is basically the equivalent of a written paragraph. It contains a lot of thoughts. It's self-contained, but it is directly related to what follows or what came previously, and of course in the overall narrative of the script. The story of the fight, that particular fight, is contained within the choreography. And it depends on how much experience the actor has had, how much training the actor has had, the type of weapon style. Most of the weapons that we had on Highlander, a lot of actors who had 90% of the people who went on Highlander as guests who had to perform fights had never touched a sword in their lives.
Right.
And people who did have training had that training 10, 15, 20 years ago and hadn't used it since. And a lot of people never had training in the sorts of weapons that I was using on Highlander, because one of the things with historical flashbacks, or just choosing a sword for a unique immortal, was about trying to get the greatest degree of diversity into the visual of the fight scene, where a person pulls out a weapon, and I would very often choose the weapon based on what I see in the script. Is there anything in the script that suggests what kind of weapon that immortal should have?
Right.
And if there wasn't, my main concern is, what haven't we seen yet?
Mm.
What can we do here that suggests and grows the backstory of that immortal a little bit more by his choice of weapon? Because all of the immortals don't necessarily have weapons that are indigenous to their original period. I mean, Mythos, for instance, is 5,000 years old, but he uses a sword of the late 14th century. That's his choice. So the ideal rehearsal period for me is as much as I can get. There is no such a thing as too much rehearsal, to be perfectly honest. You can over-rehearse scenes, but when it comes to trying to develop the muscle memory of a fight scene where you have to be able to perform the fight without consciously thinking of the moves, that is down to repetition, 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 and being comfortable with the weapon and being comfortable with your control of the weapon, so you know you aren't a danger to your fellow actor. And that is a very big psychological hurdle that a lot of actors face and must overcome. So my ideal rehearsal period is, as I said, anything and everything I can get my hands on.
Gillian, I have a question for you. When we were taking a car ride back down here, you told a really cool story, and it's something that a lot of fans have speculated, like, how did this name come about? And recently, when I was recording a Bloody Kings podcast with John Mosby, we were having the same conversation of, how did the city of Seacouver actually get its name? When was it said in the episode? How did it come about? A lot of fans don't know this question, and I want you to tell the origin of that.
And it actually came from fans. For the purposes of the show, it was set in an unnamed city in Washington State. Shows that are filmed in Vancouver are often quite open about being filmed in Vancouver. There's really been a change in people accepting that. But at the time, Vancouver was always pretending to be a generic part of the Pacific Northwest, and we used Washington State license plates and other indications that it was meant to be Washington State, but not Seattle. Vancouver doesn't look that much like Seattle, so we weren't going to try and pretend to be specifically Seattle. And the fans on the Highlander News Group that existed at the time started referring to it as Seacouver, a mixture of Seattle and Vancouver.
Do you remember about what year this was?
I mean, I came on board the show in season two. And my first time that I interacted with the fan forum was when I was looking for the fans' help, actually, in dating the first season flashbacks. The first season flashbacks don't have dates on them in the script. And then the fans had figured out what the dates were from clues in the dialogue or clues in the clothing. And so as we started season two, Adrian Paul had requested that we start keeping a timeline of Duncan's travels so he would know where he was, where he'd already been, and so we could not contradict ourselves by having him be on two sides of the world in the same year when that wasn't so easy to do. And so we were trying to build that that document, and starting from what the dates the fans had figured out for episodes that we hadn't worked on. And that's when I started interacting with the fans on that forum. So it could have been as early as season two. I think it's likely to be more like season three that that nickname got started up. You might want to find a fan historian out there who remembers those days. Some of them are still with us.
Maybe mid-94, late-94.
Could be.
Like
I mean, someone might even know the first person who used that term. I don't remember that.
But you made it official in what was it? Was it season five?
It was never said out loud on screen. We started using it as shorthand around the office, and so you would see it in scripts, but just in action lines or slug lines, not actually on screen. Like the school where Duncan taught was called Seacouver State or something like that. And then we had the opportunity, and it was in the episode The Valkyrie, where there was going to be a newspaper on screen. And we just decided to put it on that prop as kind of a nod to our longtime fans. We thought they would really enjoy seeing that. And it, you know, it came from their conversations, and that made it canon. And then after that, the fans started making like T-shirts that were like Seacouver State Athletic Club kind of stuff. It was really fun, and it definitely has stuck.
That's great that you guys paid attention to what the fans were saying. I'm sure they appreciate that. Brian, I wanted to ask you. You've done the fight choreography both here in Canada and over in Paris. Can you tell me the difference in organizing the fight choreography and dealing with all the props that are brought to you, and the comparison between here in Vancouver as opposed to Paris, France area?
Well, when I joined, we were still using Marteau as the supplier of swords. I had really no choice about that. And of course, all of the swords for the principal actors had already been set. So, you know, Duncan, Amanda, and so on and so forth, and Richie. And I had a problem with Marteau because although they are pretty swords, they're not designed to be used. They're what we call wall hangers, and they are excessively heavy. Now, bear in mind, we don't use the steel blades in the swords for anything but what are called the beauty shots, when you actually have to see the thing close up near an actor's face. We always use aluminum blades. But even so, the Marteau swords were unrealistically heavy. And when you consider that it takes at least 4 hours to film a single fight scene, for the purposes of our TV show, that's a long time for an actor to be handling a sword. In movies, I've done fight scenes where we've literally filmed one fight scene 12 hours a day for 6 consecutive days, and it's brutal. So if you don't have the muscle and the tendon flexibility and whatnot to sustain the control of a bladed weapon, you become a safety hazard. But the main problem with Marteau was that their total lack of diversity of historically authentic hilts. They were predominantly producing historical Spanish designs, and there's nothing wrong with that. Spanish swords are very, very nice. But Spanish swords, especially in the medieval period, are physically very unique in their design. And as a consequence, just looking at it automatically tells you this is a Spanish sword, even if you don't know that much. All you have to do is have seen the movie El Cid and go, that's a Spanish sword. What's it doing in Germany? What's it doing in, you know, wherever? So I basically forced them to go to another company, Museum Replica, because they had, as the name implies, replicas of swords that were based on an example in a specific museum. So these were essentially historically authentic designs predicated on a sword that actually exists somewhere in the world, but they were also made to be used, including the steel blades. These swords were made to be fought with. Wow. So, of course, we didn't use the steel blades for fighting, except for the rapiers. We always had to use steel blades for the rapiers, because an aluminum blade for a rapier is simply too thin, and it bends far too fast. And, of course, we can't be changing the blades out every two or three contacts of a sword. So the rapier scenes, those are actually steel blades. Everything else, the katanas, the medieval weapons, whatever, those are all aluminums. And we run through aluminum blades very fast because they nick deeply. That produces a safety hazard, but it also produces a cosmetic hazard. The sword is no longer camera-worthy after it really starts getting beaten around. So we changed to museum replica, and I also had the blades, the aluminum blades, made locally by Felcan Industries here in Vancouver. And then for the Highlander Endgame movie, we also, and in France, we used European sword suppliers. The French sword supplier for Highlander was Jean-Paul Maratier and Company, and it was a company that rented everything, especially swords and weapons and whatnot, he and his sons, and they also produced the aluminum blades. Sometimes I would have a sword completely custom-made from scratch. Sometimes that was made in L.A. by Tony Swatton, Sword in the Stone, or which a lot of the swords for Endgame were made there. But by and large, I brought my own katanas with me and a big shipment of blades from Felcan here in Vancouver, because they make absolutely fantastic blades, absolutely amazing blades. They look great, but they're entirely functional. The less I had to depend on the French end to produce the blades for the katanas and whatnot, the easier it was, because it put less demand on the French group. And I already knew that I didn't have to compromise swords by sending them out to have them refitted by a company that hadn't made them previously. So we were getting swords and blades from like three or four different sources.
Right.
In France, we were holding an awful lot of the scripts for historical flashbacks to when we got to France, so we actually had to, we were able to use the real locations, real castles, real chateaus. Things that were simply not available to us in Canada were totally unrealistic financially to build or CGI or anything like this. So some of the choices of what we did in the action was predicated on historical flashbacks, and the historical flashbacks were predicated on, are we in France or are we in Canada?
Gotcha. Wow, very cool. Wow.
I have something to say, because Bron mentioned using real chateaus in France. So when we were filming in Vancouver, we always used to joke that if we asked in the script for some kind of very special location that had something unique about it, Ken Gord would tell us he couldn't get it, and we'd just go in and he'd just get us a warehouse instead. But if we put in the script that the fight took place in a warehouse, Ken would say, oh, I have an abandoned amusement park we can use. So we quickly learned to just say warehouse and let him tell us what cool thing he had.
Gotcha.
And in France, the same thing applied to chateau. We would just put everything in a chateau and be like, well, Ken will find something. Chateau was like the generic, the warehouse of France. And I'll tell you something that is listed in the script as a chateau: Kronos' headquarters.
Really? That's funny.
Chateau. And Ken's like, well, I have this submarine base.
It's better than an amusement park.
Look, it's a chateau to him.
Honestly, if we'd ever written in the script interior abandoned submarine base, he'd be like, are you kidding me? But I'll get you a chateau.
That's funny.
And the fight was written assuming there would be a chateau. I mean, I remember a specific line where it was like, you know, Duncan jumps up onto a low wall. And it's just like, but we don't rewrite them. Like, Bron doesn't send us his script and then we fix the script to match it. He just, you know, he reads our script, he goes, okay, this is meant to be a retreating scene, I don't have a low wall, I use, you know, whatever they have. He choreographs the story of it, as opposed to the physicality that we don't know where they're going to be standing on.
Well, I have to choreograph based on where the locations are, and I don't have a choice.
Right.
The scenes that Gillian is alluding to, it was a World War II Nazi submarine base. It was a U-boat base. and its ceiling was 30, 40 feet thick, solid concrete. And if you went up onto the roof of this thing, you realized that it had suffered massive carpet bombing by B-17s and Lancasters and had barely scratched the surface. And there were submarine panels all through this thing. So at the end, when we were doing the quickening, obviously they wanted big geyser bursts and whatnot coming out of the water. And as they were planting the explosive charges and the air rams to create these water geysers, somebody said, "You do know, do you not, that somewhere under the silt in one or two of these slips, we are pretty sure there are unexploded torpedoes."
Oh my gosh.
That slipped off and fell in while they were trying to hurriedly load the U-boats to get them out into the water.
I'm sure Kronos knew about that.
And we had this God almighty immortal shaboom at the very end.
Danger and, UXB.
And for one horrible second I thought, my God, it was a torpedo. It wasn't, of course, but that was just sort of... That was sort of icing on the cake of going, oh, great, that could be interesting. That could be the quickening to end all quickenings, literally. They didn't manage to destroy this base from the outside by bombing it. We'll destroy it from the inside.
Gilly, I want to ask you a follow-up question. When you mentioned that, and I'd heard this before, that Adrian wanted a timeline of his adventures, basically.
He did, and correctly so. And that was a good idea.
I have a follow-up question to that. So you have about 400 years to work with here with this character.
Right.
As the seasons were going along with you, did it get a little bit more difficult? Was there any examples of anything that, you know, you had to either, oops, you had to change? Was there an episode that something else had to change because he should have been here instead? Was there anything like that?
It absolutely did get more difficult. Like 400 years seems like a lot until you have made 116 episodes. But... you know, it's a long time ago, so I know that there was some situation that we were sort of stuck with from the first season, which left us with Duncan having to go to the Far East twice. That I believe it is actually Mountain Men that shows him in the New World at a really awkward time in his timeline. Like, the rest of his timeline might be, like, a nice, smooth, you know, move from, like, Europe to the Far East and then to the New World. And instead he makes this one weird trip to the New World and then back out to Japan. And we were like, you know, we can't erase first season flashbacks, so we just have to explain it to ourselves. You know, it was so heartbroken he left. But unfortunately, without refreshing my memory with the timeline, be like, gotcha. You might want to ask me this question again another time when I've had time to check in with Donna and get the details of it right.
I had this question for both you guys. One thing I wanted to ask was, we were talking about early Highlander conventions. When do you guys remember that maybe we should have one? What kind of feedback are you getting from fans that we really want to see these people live, you want to see what they're like in person? When did that buzz start happening, like, you should probably do this?
So I grew up in fandom. I've been going to conventions since I was in high school for various shows that I liked. I was going to sci-fi. Donna and I met at a Worldcon. That's where we met for the first time. So we both came from that culture, and we were well aware of the fan situation. And we were basically taking Highlander material to general conventions. I mean, we went to San Diego Comic-Con back when you could just put your own...
The good old days.
Right. You could put your panel on. You could email them and say, oh, can we bring the Highlander panel down? And they would just give you a room. It's not quite like that anymore. But we would do that to any convention that was close enough for us to travel to. We would bring outtakes and cool behind-the-scenes stuff to conventions. And the conventional producers, our bosses, were just not really familiar with that side of the culture. And so the first conventions were absolutely fan-generated. The producers didn't necessarily quite understand it. When Crystal, who ran the first fan club... When Christmas, who ran the first fan club, organized the first convention, the guys didn't object to it.
Where was that first convention again?
Denver.
Denver.
Yeah. The guys didn't really understand the appeal of it. David Abramowitz did not go. I went and I called him from there and I said, you really should be here. I said, like, the love for Highlander is ankle deep in the hallways and you can just sort of scoop it up and pour it over your head. And he was the, you know, he was the man behind the show. And I felt like he was missing out on a beautiful experience. After that, he started coming. And once he went to his first one, he got it. He understood what it was. And then walking around general conventions in my Highlander crew jacket, I had people trying to buy it off me. So I'm also going to take credit for convincing Bill Panzer that they needed to start selling t-shirts and jackets, which turned into quite the merchandising empire. I mean, we were really on the forefront. Highlander was available on home video when most television shows were not. This was, you know, it was really out on the vanguard. And that was due to the fact of having such a committed fandom. Like most shows, if they had been released on videotape, people would not have bought it. But that, you know, the impetus for that was driven by the fans organizing their own get-togethers, and that sort of demonstrated there's this hunger out there. And I mean, we also had the advantage of outtakes. Not every show had these 4 extra minutes per episode that only aired in Europe and didn't air in the US. So that our committed fan base knew that if they bought those videotape sets, it wasn't just to watch the show again. They were going to get new material. And that's a pretty unusual situation. That didn't apply to a lot of other shows. So that really worked in our favor.
I wanted to ask you, Bron, about, you alluded to your first convention earlier today. Tell me about what you remember from that. And was it something that caught you off guard? What were you expecting from it?
Well, it was the second Denver convention. And it was the year after I had joined the show. So I had been to a couple of conventions before, sci-fi conventions like TorCon in Toronto and whatnot, as an invited guest to speak about certain things, because I write as well. But I'd also been doing, you know, I'm an actor, I've done some science fiction films, one of which does not appear on my resume and never will, but what the hell. And I, you know, I was also known as, to a much lesser extent, as a fight choreographer, because most of my work as an actor and a fight choreographer had been done on stage. So it was sort of, it wasn't as though I had no experience with conventions at all in terms of, yes, this is what they are, this is, you know, what they do. But it was the first time that I was going to a convention in that kind of capacity, realizing I haven't appeared in front of the camera yet. I'm choreographing the fights, yes, that's interesting, but here's Adrian Paul, here's Stan Kirsch, here's Elizabeth Grayson, here's, you know, and people like David Abramowitz and the people who are the mainstay of the show. I provide one venue, and I seem to have gotten somewhat popular. But that's fine, because if I've brought some added value to the show by expanding characterization and telling new stories of the script through the fight scenes and whatnot, that's what we're all supposed to do. Gillian brings us incredible stories. David Abramowitz brings us incredible stories. Tynan, same thing. They provide everything we need to work with, and then we add our stuff to that. Without them, I couldn't do what I do. But on the other hand, I can add stuff that they can't, because I'm much more specialized. I am only just now beginning to start to do on an extremely amateurish basis what they do. And I fully appreciate, always have had as an actor, tremendous appreciation for the writers, because, like I said, without them, it's mime. So, you know, we all do what we can to give the fans, the viewing audience, the best possible experience we can. And that's, I think, why we lasted 6 years.
I mean, I do think that, you know, the Highlander is fairly unique in having a swordmaster, which
it was the only show on television that required a full-time swordmaster.
And that, so it doesn't surprise me that fans would want to hear the stories from the swordmaster. Part of the appeal of the show were the sword fights.
Yeah.
We've always said how lucky we were to have Adrian with his training, because the show would never have been the same if we'd had to cut away to a stunt double for Duncan. That would just, it would not have had the impact on viewers that it did. And some of our viewers were people who loved sword fighting and you know, historical reenacting before they ever saw the show. And then other viewers came to it. Like, after watching the show, they got interested now in sword fighting. And so the notion of being able to hear behind-the-scenes stories about that side of it, I think that has more of an automatic appeal to the viewership than hearing about how the sets were designed and the costumes designed, even though that stuff is interesting to us as insiders. I think that when you're holding a convention, you can see where people are going to be like, oh yeah, I want that sword guy here.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. Okay. As we wrap this up, I gotta ask you guys one last thing here. I'm really curious about your opinion, and I want to start with you, Gillian, because since you've written for Highlander, you've been part of the creative process for Highlander. I want to get your opinion on this potential new reboot of Highlander. As we know, Chad Stahelski, the director of the John Wick films, is really interested in doing this. And it looks like it's going to happen. Whether it's going to be a movie, he's kind of alluded to a possible TV series now. What do you want to see from a Highlander reboot?
So I have the advantage, I think, of having grown up on comic books where the origin stories get retold periodically, that if you follow a certain character over the years, you're going to see different teams' takes on the same character. And therefore, it's not of concern to me. Like, if somebody takes over the Spider-Man book and writes a different version of what happened to Uncle Ben, it doesn't erase the old books. You can still buy them. You can still read them. Whichever one you grew up with, that can still be the one you love the best. And so if they want to make some more Highlander material, coming from a person who's never been involved with it before, so they're not going to be bringing any of our baggage or expectations to it. They're just going to come at it with what's important to them. That's exciting to me. I might or might not like it, but it doesn't damage what we made. If they take it in a new direction, if they don't follow the rules that we set for ourselves, it's not a problem. I mean, look at the new Doctor Who, right? As people who grew up with Doctor Who, starting their own version of it, and you can. As a fan, you're free to take it or leave it. So I approach the new Highlander as a fan.
What about you, Bron? What do you want to see from the new Highlander?
I want to see something that involves me.
I was just about to say.
Well,
I
mean,
him to be the swordmaster.
Touche.
Well,
can I change my answer?
Yeah.
Of course I do. I want to work, but the thing that would be exciting to me, regardless of where the storyline goes, if they start from scratch and reboot it from literally concept one, day one, or whether it becomes a continuation of what has been done in the past, I just look at that as a new opportunity to tell more and more exciting stories. Because I have certainly not stopped studying and evolving as a fight choreographer and historical researcher from the last episode of Highlander to the present day. I have a lot more that I can bring to that kind of a show now than I could when I originally started. I mean, you come to the show with everything you've got. Hopefully, the longer that you live, the more you can bring to projects because you are constantly growing. As a friend of mine, Tony DeLongis, and I have always said, is you're training, you're not training for the job you have. You're training for the job you don't have yet. And that's why it's so important to continue to grow as an artist, because that's the only way you progress, and that's the way you see things in different lights. Because I look back at what I know now, at what I did on Highlander, and I have to be careful not to kick myself going, oh, damn, I could have done this, I could have done that. I said, well, yes, but if I'd have known then what I know now, I would have done it. It's part of growing and evolving. The story of Highlander will grow and evolve, and regardless of who takes it over and what direction they go, as long as they're faithful to the concepts in Highlander that were the most important concepts, which are all the character-driven concepts. That's the thing that makes the show.
Guys, first, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a blast, and I really, really appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
And everybody should make a visit to Seacouver when they have a chance.
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely. This has been a fantastic experience for me, too. Like I said, I'm seeing an awful lot of these locations for the first time in over 20 years, and in some cases, I'm seeing them for the first time, period.
Well, Andy, do you have anything else you want to say to people that might come next time?
Well, hopefully from the interviews and all the photos that you have seen, that this will entice you to come along and see the things you've been missing out on.
I just want to say on a personal note, Vancouver is one of the most beautiful cities that I've been to, and the people are great, and you, on this tour, you get to see pretty much almost everything. Guys, thanks again very much.
Thank you.
All right, we hope you guys enjoyed that interview with F. Bron McAsh, the Swordmaster of the Highlander TV series, and Gillian Horvath, Associate Creative Consultant and Script Coordinator. These guys are awesome, really fun to hang out with. We took some pictures when we were up at one of the mountains there, and it was great because both Andy, myself, and F. Bron both had Highlander leather jackets, and we took some fun pictures of that, and we really hope that you guys enjoyed that. Before we move on, though, I want to let you know want you guys to listen to our Fandom Podcast Network promo, letting you know what else is on the network. Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. For you Highlander fans, we've got Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we cover all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater is for you movie buffs, our podcast celebrating the cult classics and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. We also have End Zone for you NFL fans, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast with hosts Tom, Brandon, and Chris discussing the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock. And for you Star Trek Discovery and Orville fans, we have Discoville, talking about everything Discovery and the Orville. And for you hard rock music fans, we have the Hair Metal Podcast. The Hair Metal Podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And we also have Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, where we discuss all things Doctor Who, both past and present. And our newest podcast, Lethal Mullet, our podcast celebrating action movies from the 1980s with your host, Adam P. O'Brien. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network master feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play, and now on Spotify. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network, on Instagram, Fandom Podcast Network, and also on Twitter at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and supporting the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom. All right, welcome back, guys. This has been Blood of Kings 114, Seacouver Tour Chronicles, Part 4, our interview with Highlander alumni F. Bron McAsh and Gillian Horvath. We hope you guys really enjoyed the interview. It was really fun to hang out with those two. Met them, of course, at Highlander conventions, and look forward to seeing them again. It was interesting, too, to hear Gillian talk about how she didn't get a chance to do a lot of location visits. And so it was kind of fun for her to do that with Andy and I and with F. Bron. And F. Bron explaining that, he didn't get to see a lot of locations, too, that didn't require him to be there because there weren't any fight scenes. He was obviously there for the fight scene. So that was an interesting perspective as well. We hope you guys have been enjoying this series of the
Seacouver Tour Chronicles. And we want to let you know we're not done yet. We got one more left. We have Blood of Kings episode 115, our Seacouver Tour Chronicles part 5, our interview with Highlander actor Jay Brazzo. If you don't know who Jay is, I guarantee you have seen his face. He played the commissioner in a couple of the early episodes of Highlander. This guy's IMDb credits is extensive, and this guy was great to talk to. Wonderful guy, wonderful actor. He's been in so many things. We also have our interview with Paul Bartlett, and as I mentioned earlier, he worked at the theater where Song of the Executioner was filmed, and he took some time to talk with us, and he also showed us around the entire theater. If you guys have not been into the insides and the inner works of a theater, a really working theater with stage play and stuff like that, it's really fascinating, especially when you get to go under and check out the stage, and you get to go over and see the lighting. This theater was a great location for this, so we hope that you guys enjoy that interview next week. Well, anyway, I want to thank our special guest, F. Bron McAsh and Gillian Horvath. Thank you guys so much. And on behalf of my special guests, Bron and Gillian, thanks everyone for listening. And join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network for another episode of Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast. Bron, Gillian, that sensation you are feeling is the quickening. We are one. We are immortals. Goodbye, everyone.